this idea that time is some kind of universal thing that you can define, a great clock in the sky. That's what Isaac Newton would have said. But actually, Einstein showed us that it's not that simple at all.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of our Partners in Time podcast. It's been a while that I've been in this podcast studio, but today we're going to be talking to Brian Cox. Brian Cox is a world-renowned physicist, astrophysicist who's teaching all over the planet and also has a run of live shows happening with a global tour at the moment, explaining some of the most fascinating concepts about the universe, about time and eternity to audience all around the planet. Now, the reason why we're talking to Brian today is, of course, it's the Eve of Watches and Wonders 2024, which will kick off in Geneva next week. And in the context of what we're about to unveil and launch at Watches and Wonders, Brian will give us a little bit of a teaser and a bit of a context into some of the big questions about time. So, Brian, thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
So I understand you're in the middle of a busy schedule of shows. You're doing your tour at the moment of theatre shows. Tell our listeners a little bit about what it is you do on stage.
Yes. Well, I pose a question initially, which fits in beautifully with what we're going to talk about today, which is, what does it mean to live a finite, fragile life in an infinite, eternal universe? And it's a show about cosmology and astronomy, the size and scale of the universe, life in the universe, the nature of space and time, black holes, the end of time, the beginning of time. I say that at the start. I say all the small, all the little things.
Yeah, we're little talk details about our daily lives.
Yes, but it does. I think anyone who just thinks for a moment about the size and scale of the universe is faced with these philosophical questions. It's not just science. It's very easy to say, there are 2 trillion galaxies in the part of the universe we can see, which is the observable universe. And the universe may extend way beyond the horizon, possibly infinite, we don't know. So that's the science. We've observed that, we've measured it. But what we're to make of that, what it means, I think, I don't know about you, but I can't think, well, I can't picture the size and scale of the universe, but I certainly find it very difficult to decide what that means for my existence in it.
You know, I was smiling when I walked up to the podcast studio, because my lovely colleagues always prepare like a little question guide sheet for me walking into these podcasts. And basically, this one looks very easy because I'm asking you, what's the universe? What is time? What is eternity? And I think 60 minutes done. For me, this is going to be an extremely easy podcast to navigate. it's not the small questions, definitely not. But maybe let's you talked about the observable universe, and maybe let's start right there, because, we've noticed, especially in our profession as watchmakers, as engineers, when you go back and you look at the history of timekeeping, the history of instruments in a wider sense, you see that humans from the dawn of time have been fascinated, if not obsessed, by actually observing what we can see from our small planet and trying to make sense of it and trying to package what we can see and observe into something meaningful that we can then sort of control and devise into, different units that can be measured and related to. So, does that make us unique as humans to try and make sense of our universe and of concepts like time and space in this way?
Well, yes, it does on this planet, certainly. And actually, it raises the question, well, on how many other planets has that happened? If you think about what we are, we mentioned that the word human, there are different levels of description of a human being. One is just a collection of atoms. I remember my great hero Carl Sagan said that a physicist, which are humans, right? An example of a human, a physicist.
Sort of.
A physicist is a hydrogen atom's way of learning about hydrogen atoms. And it goes to the heart of your question. It's a remarkable thing that these collections of atoms that we call us, me and you, are able to think about and discover these profound things about nature. And it's not long, to go to the heart of your question. It's only, I suppose, you could say Copernicus, it's 500 years ago maybe, that we were demoted from the center of the universe by our observations of it. And by the way, it's entirely natural to imagine we're at the center of the universe. Aristotle made a beautiful argument for it. He said, well, it's self-evident that we're not moving. Everything falls towards the earth and everything is going around it. Well, none of that's true, but it feels true. So yeah, it's a remarkable thing.
From his perspective, you know, that kind of Newton under the apple tree kind of moment.
Yeah, I mean, so it feels as if we're immobile at the center of things. And I think that's the remarkable thing about the progress we've made in the last few hundred years, certainly a few hundred years, that we've asked questions, as you said, about the nature of space and time, which in some sense actually emerged from this observation that it doesn't feel as if we're moving, but we're in orbit around the sun. The sun is in orbit around the Milky Way galaxy. The discovery that there are other galaxies is a 1920s discovery. It's remarkable. It's only 100 years ago.
Yeah, that is remarkable when you think about it. And today, when you look at today's context and how fundamentally, profoundly worried we are about a potentially sentient AI in the future, and you said, you know, it's us atoms thinking about atoms, you know, then it's maybe an artificial intelligence thinking about itself. Yeah. You know, it doesn't reflect very well on what we think of ourselves. In that context, we are worried about something which we do uniquely all of the time, you know, which is being able to question our own existence, our own purpose, and make sense of the world around us, which I think is really one of those core human traits that have enabled our industry, things like mechanical watchmaking, you know, which is really trying to put together mechanically programmed little supercomputers that can make sense and get to a ridiculous level of precision of describing something which seems very, very difficult to grasp. But maybe give our listeners a sense of, we've discussed it before in terms of your approach to understanding time as an entity, you know, because for us, looking at our watches as a basic concept, it's quite simple with 60 seconds in a minute, 12 hours, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it's more complicated than that when you look at it from a universal perspective, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I think once Einstein was once asked, what is time? And he said, and he was sort of joking, he said, well, it's the thing you measure with the clock. But he wasn't joking, because that's the existence of clocks, the existence of things that measure time is assumed in Einstein's theory of space-time. So I should say that Einstein's theory of gravity, that general relativity published in 1915, is still by far our best theory of gravity. We've made no observation in the history of astronomy to this day that has contradicted Einstein's picture. It essentially predicted black holes. It describes black holes. It describes with absolute precision how the planets orbit around the sun and so everything we see in the universe. And yet, that theory takes a clock as something that's an axiom, it's a prerequisite, it's a thing that measures time. That there's an interpretation, by the way, which is very beautiful in Einstein's theory, of what your age is. So you imagine you had a perfect watch, an IWC watch that's perfect time, and you set it going at the moment you were born, and you carry it with you for your whole life. And then you look at it now. So it's recorded time. Now, it's obviously recorded your age. It sat with you for your whole life. But in Einstein's theory, it's recorded the distance you have traveled over space-time. So it's a picture. If you can, picture a map, which is not just a map of the surface of the Earth or a map of the universe. It's a map of space and time, which means that every event, every moment that's happened in the history of the universe and will ever happen would be a point on the map. The idea really is that if you sat there with your watch that you carried with you your whole life and noted down the time and place of all the moments, everything that happens to you in your life, plotted those things on this map and then joined it up, that line, the length of that line, the distance you have traveled over the map is your age. So it's a very beautiful, I think, interpretation of what time is, that it's measuring a distance you're traveling over the surface of reality in some sense.
Just at least implies we're going forward, which is...
Well, and that's a very deep observation, actually, because you might say, well, if I picture a map of the past, present, and future, of everything, then why can't I wander around with freedom over the map? And actually, Einstein's theory is very clever, that it prevents you from wandering around with absolute freedom. That would be a time machine. And as far as we know, you can't do that. So you don't have complete freedom in the way you move over the map. But
another enticing concept, definitely, if you can physically wind back the time and off you go.
But still, yeah, absolutely. But still, there's this idea of something that's measuring something, which is a clock that's ticking. And we get into a very deep, actually, we don't know. If you ask me, it'd be a very short answer. If you ask me what is time, the actual answer is don't know.
Well,
we don't know.
That's a great start for this year with the launch that's coming up for us at Watches and Wonders. But you know, for us mere mortals here on Earth, if we take a step back, we are observing and measuring the solar year, I suppose, as a basic. It's all about that orbit and the recurring seasons on Earth. I guess from an Earth perspective, that is what we're measuring when we're measuring time. Is that right?
Well, I mean, historically, yes. Now, interestingly, because we have atomic clocks, which measure time with incredible precision, then we have to resync time, because the orbit of the Earth, the rotation of the Earth, you know, we say, well, how long is a day? 24 hours. It isn't. Yeah. It varies. It wobbles a tiny amount, but enough so that we have to add in leap years, leap centuries, leap seconds, and so on, in order to stay in sync with what we used to think time was, right? Which is, as you said, is, I suppose, it's a way of calibrating or measuring our position in our orbit around the sun and the rotation of our Earth on its axis. But because now we measure time so precisely, we see that they wobble, we have to keep resyncing.
Yeah, but basically outside the solar system, is that concept of time still valid to an extent, or do we have to rethink the concept of time completely into what you described in space-time once we leave our solar system?
Well, we could explain to an alien civilization who would clearly have a different year and a different day. We could explain to them what a second is, and the modern way of doing that would be to go through things that everyone would agree upon, like the speed of light.
Yeah.
If you say, what's the speed of light? It's a universal number. If you try to put a number on it, then it tells you about the way you measure distance and the way you measure time. And you can, so you have to sort of explain our system of measurements to an alien civilization. But that we could translate very easily between what we call a second, which, as you said, is historic in its definition. But we could explain it to them. So we think these things, that there are fundamental properties of nature that would provide a universal language to discuss time.
We think, hopefully. Okay. Now you touched on that element of the day not being quite 24 hours, the year not being quite 365 days, and all of those little wobbles in the time continuum. And it's fascinating, you know, I just started to really research this whole idea of the different calendar systems over time, and obviously that Western calendar, Julian calendar, sort of allowing for a once every 4 year correction of that leap year, adding in the extra day to sort of account for some of that imprecision you have in the 365 day cycle. And then obviously in the 1500s at some point, that idea of Pope Gregor introducing the Gregorian calendar, which on top of that put in a correction three times in 400 years, if I got this right. So yeah, there should be 100 leap years in a 400-year period, but there's only 97, because I think they figured out one day that Easter ended up in summer, which was a bit inconvenient for the church. Yeah. So they said, okay, we're going to do something about this. But then, of course, it took quite a long time for most nations and cultures and places around the world to adopt like a single calendar system. And non-surprisingly, apparently there were two villages in Graubünden in Switzerland which adopted the Gregorian calendar years after everybody else. So I'm really surprised it wasn't Schaffhausen. But talk us a little bit through that. You know, how does humanity agree on that sort of system and what kind of corrections? Because, I mean, today, I mean, just imagine the nightmare. If we were to say, look, we have to change this calendar, it's clearly not working out. So instead of it being the 27th of February today, it's going to be the 3rd of March. I mean, that's going to cause all sorts of nightmares.
Well, it's a remarkable, you're right. I mean, it's one of those examples of our global civilization, every country in the world having to agree on something.
We couldn't agree on sockets and plug systems in the European Union, for starters.
Exactly. So I do find it remarkable. And so we have Greenwich, for example, the Greenwich Meridian, because, of course, time is intimately related with navigation. So agreeing this, we could call it a coordinate system in terms of latitude and longitude and where is the zero. And how do we measure time?
It's very handy.
Of course, it's all related. And you think, would it be possible today? You know, maybe not. But it's ultimately what we're trying to do is there are two things. One is we'd like to keep our, as you said, our system of months and years in sync with what? Well, with the sky, essentially. So we have the Earth orbiting around the sun and wobbling all over the place. And so we're trying to keep the sky in sync with our clocks, and of course we can't do anything about the sky, so we have to change our clocks. But also it becomes much deeper today because keeping, for example, computer systems in sync with each other is extremely important. An interesting property of time is that it doesn't pass at the same rate in different places. So, for example, and this is really important, it passes at a different rate in orbit than it does on the ground. And so that you might say, well, it doesn't matter, but it does, because our satellite navigation system requires timekeeping, high-precision timekeeping. And it requires such high-precision timekeeping that we see the difference in the rate of passage of time in our atomic clocks on the ground and our atomic clocks in orbit. You even see the difference between an atomic clock in somewhere like Denver and an atomic clock in London because of the altitude difference. And wow. So this idea that time is some kind of universal thing that you can define a great clock in the sky, that's what Isaac Newton would have said. But actually Einstein showed us that it's not that simple at all. So you have to all agree on what are we going to synchronize with what? Which clock are we going to synchronize with? And the clock could be an atomic clock at some particular altitude in some place on the Earth's surface. And also we want to keep that in sync with the clocks in the sky, which is the motion of the Earth. So it becomes wonderfully complicated.
Yeah. So how big are the deviations when you say different atomic clocks at different altitudes and then the ones that run the satellites? You know?
So the drift in GPS is something like 36,000 nanoseconds per day. So that's 36,000. A nanosecond is 1,000 millionths of a second.
Gosh.
So 36,000 nanoseconds. Now, the reason I put it in those terms is this is a very England-centric thing to say, UK-centric, but light travels 1 foot per nanosecond. So for everybody else in the world, that's about 30 centimeters. But it's a rather nice rule of thumb. So it's 30 centimeters. So you think about it in terms of position. If you're trying to measure position in terms of light travel time, 36,000 nanoseconds is 36,000 feet, it's 10 kilometers or something like that, right? 10.
Yeah.
So it's... These are very big drifts.
Significant, yes.
So I should say that drift in the GPS system is due to two things, which are the two things that that Einstein would say. What affects the passage of time? One is, well, gravity is, to a good approximation, the distortion in time. So gravity itself is due to time and space, but actually being distorted by the presence of the Earth. So if you allow for the idea that the Earth distorts space-time, distorts time, then clearly the further away you get from it, time passes at a different rate.
Yeah.
That's the first thing.
Whatever else influences you when you're far away from Earth, you know.
Yeah, it's literally distorting it. And the other thing is actually relative motion changes the way that clocks tick relative to each other. So these satellites are moving very fast compared to the ground. They're in orbit, and they're not in what's called the geostationary orbit, which means they'd stay in one place. They're low down, so they're moving extremely fast, and they're in a different gravitational field, which means time's distorted in a different way. And so you put all those things together, and you get this this very remarkable calculation that time, it's not the clocks. I should always emphasize that. I have to, when I teach this at university, there's a tendency for people to think there's something happening with a clock. So maybe it'd be different if you had a mechanical watch or a atomic clock or a biological clock. That's your age, right? It's exactly the same. These things are measuring time, and it's time that's distorted.
Wow.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, if not mind-blowing, I think, when you start to think about things in terms. First of all, it gives you a completely new respect for your sat-nav in your car, for sure, being able to pinpoint you relatively well. And also this whole idea of slowing down time through going to a different place, moving at a different speed, you know, everything we've seen sort of in Netflix's Manifest, at least the non-weird parts when literally people disappear and then time hasn't moved for them, but everybody else is like 5 years ahead. Is that a thing then, even?
Yes. I mean, you know, so many people will be familiar with Interstellar, I suppose. It was a tremendously successful film. And that film was put together, actually. The initial idea came from, in part, from Kip Thorne, who's one of the world experts on general relativity, time and space. He has a Nobel Prize for detecting ripples in space-time called gravitational waves. He told me once, he described, so we have a detector now called LIGO, gravitational wave detector, and he said it detects storms in time. So it sees black holes colliding together billions of light years away. And when that such violent events happen in the universe, you get ripples in time that come through, and we can detect them, a storm in time. And so, but he had a great deal to do with the concept of that film. And so when you see that the astronauts go down onto a planet orbiting around a black hole, and then they come off the planet again, and they find that an hour has passed for them and 7 years has passed outside, or it's a huge amount. Yeah. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's years for seconds or minutes. That's absolutely the way it is. That's what we're seeing in GPS. So we're seeing that the Earth is distorting space-time a bit. A black hole distorts it a lot. So if you go close to a black hole, you experience a very different... I have to be very careful. You don't experience a different passage of time. For you, if you have your IWC watch on and you look at it, it will show 1 second per second ticking along. You will see it tick at the rate you always see it tick at. Your time is personal to you in relativity, but in nature, in the universe, your time is personal to you. So everybody sees their watch mark time in the way they would expect it to. But when you come back and meet somebody else that's been in a different place, they will have gone out of sync.
Wow. Yeah. So that means, like, literally, if we absolutely set our perpetual calendars to the same time, date, to the second, and I go close to a black hole for a bit, and time passes differently for me, that my watch starts, it carries on ticking as normal, I come back to Earth, I meet the other person, our watches will show a different time and date, even possibly.
Radically different, yes. Wow. If you go close to a black hole, I'll tell you the way to picture it.
We should try it. Trip.
It's a very beautiful way to picture it, actually. Which is, remember I talked about the map of space and time. Yeah. So to visualize this map where all the moments of your life and everybody's life points on this map, and I said that the amount you age between two events, two moments, two things that happen, is the length, the distance you've traveled over the map. So if that moment is us now sitting talking to each other, and then we agree to come back and talk to each other again in a year's time. So those are two events in space-time that we're both present at. But in the intervening year, we could take radically different paths over space-time, over the map. You'd notice if you went, one of us went very close to the speed of light, relative to the other one. Or, as you said, we went close to something like a black hole then we'd notice an enormous effect. And it's not, by the way, you can, if you go very close to the speed of light or very close to a black hole, you can make that effect not just seconds or minutes, but millions of years. So we could arrange it so that for me, if I go off on my spacecraft and I travel very close to the speed of light and then come back again, I could come back 10 million years in your future.
Wow.
Or 20 million. Okay. Actually, technically, infinitely far, right? So, but you've got to go very, very close to the speed of light or very, very close to a black hole and orbit around very close to it in order to get those enormous time differences in what we measure between the distance between these two events.
Is that something that astronauts have ever physically experienced? Has that happened, that astronauts have come back and there is it? I mean, it's obviously not going to be in millions of years, clearly, but is that a thing?
It is, but it's a tiny amount for the astronauts because they're not far away from the Earth or they're not going very fast compared to the speed of light. But it was measured very, very famously with two atomic clocks on airliners traveling different routes around the Earth in the 1960s. It could have been 1950s, so that'll be a fact check. But it's a very famous experiment. And there's a beautiful paper that was written at the end of it where they said, oh, Einstein was right. So it's been measured on atomic clocks carried on airliners. Mm. But we're talking for anything that we are able to do. So the speeds we're able to travel relative to each other, they're so tiny.
So tiny, yeah.
That we're talking nanoseconds, as I said. But it's true that the astronauts on the space station age at a different rate to the people on the ground.
Explains why Thomas Pesquet looks so incredibly young. He's, by the way, exactly the same age as me with the same birthday. I must say happy birthday today. It's birthday today as well. So, no, that's that's why he keeps getting younger by the years. Too much time on the space station, for sure. So something that absolutely blew my mind when we discussed it with the engineers the other day, you know, when we talk about perpetual calendars, in my usual introduction to perpetual calendars, when I speak about that fascinating function of actually being able to have a calendar programmed correctly to observe the moon phases and to be able to predict, or not predict, but program the leap years correctly, etc., etc. And then you talk about how you get to and past all the irregularities of the calendar. And then you get to the year 3999, which is the last year before the year 4000. And usually I always say to people, well, actually, nobody needs a perpetual calendar as a mechanical watch because all we need to do is check our phones and we see exactly all the information there. But then I'm being told that for the year 4000, it hasn't actually yet been decided whether that's going to be a leap year or not. And kind of the Gregorian calendar ends in 3999. And after that, we're not quite sure. Now, that is that's quite a daunting thought, isn't it? Because you'd think, you know, I mean, I remember the millennium bug, but we generally look at our computer systems and mentioned atomic clocks and everything else. And you think, yeah, it's all under control. But it's not that far in the distant future when you think, well, 4000, we don't really know what's going to happen calendar-wise.
No, because we don't know. The Earth's wobbling, the changes in the Earth's rotation rate are determined by so many things. Even the prevailing winds blowing on mountains changes the Earth's rotation rate. These are tiny effects, but over time they build up. Mm. And as you say, I mean, if you imagine, the thing I love so much about mechanical calendars, about the eternal calendar, is that, as you said, it's a mechanical computer. And it makes real for me the fact that time is a physical thing. So it's not just something you read on a display. You know, that takes you away from it. There's some more visceral connection you get with you know, cogwheels and springs that makes it clear that time is a property of nature. It's a property of the universe that we don't understand, which makes it romantic to me.
Yeah.
And the idea that so this thing is measuring something, this watch, but as you said, is it synchronized with the orbit of the Earth? Well, no. And so that will drift over time. So, but it's measuring something. And the Earth, you know, the orbit of the Earth is, you could say that's a clock.
Yeah.
It's measuring something as well, but it's less accurate than an IWC watch.
No, and obviously this is the beautiful thing about, you know, watchmakers and engineers, you know, literally investing a lifetime's work to try and get as precisely as possible, as closely as possible to sort of the true behavior of the Earth and the solar rotation and the lunation as well, which is that pursuit, you know. I think for me always in these kind of conversations, that's when I feel that engineering spirit the most, because people will literally go far, far beyond, you know, what you'd even call the extra mile to try and get just that, you know, tiny fraction of a second closer to the real number of the year, the day, et cetera, et cetera. And we were talking about gear ratios yesterday morning with our technical director, Stefan, and he was explaining to me the rotation of this one particular cogwheel. And he was telling me about the degrees and the teeth and this and the other. And he said, but basically, to put that into perspective, in your entire lifetime, this is not going to even complete a complete, you know, full revolution in your whole lifetime. You think, okay, that is slow.
Isn't that beautiful? It's profoundly important as well, isn't it? Because it somehow connects us to the wider universe. This fact that there is this thing out there which is, you know, we could say it's 13.8 billion years old, although that's the time back to when to the Big Bang. We don't even know whether that was the beginning of time, by the way. So it's lazy to say 13.8 billion years old. There was something interesting happened then, but we're not sure. but then, as far as we can tell, into the future, there's an eternity in a sense that we think that the universe is going to carry on expanding forever. Although it might not, but it probably will, as far as we understand at the moment. But things might change. But so it seems like there's an eternity. But at some point in the future, and we're talking about now a trillion years or more, no stars will shine. So we do know the universe is kind of winding down in a way. That more stars are dying and not being replenished. As fast as they're dying, and that's just the way the universe is. And so at some point in the future, we have a universe filled with black holes, and Stephen Hawking told us that even they have a lifetime. And once they're gone, there's no way of measuring time. So in some sense, you can say that time stops or ceases to have a meaning at some point, perhaps in the distant future. But these times, that's what I love about timekeeping, is that the more you think about it, as you said, it's even remarkable that we synchronize it with the motion of a planet. Even that's a recent discovery.
It is.
but then the fact that when you really think about the way the universe is going to evolve over trillions and trillions and trillions of years, you get into very deep questions about whether if there's anything left in the universe, which we don't think there will be, by the way, in the far, far future, whether time has any meaning at all then.
Yeah, that's the big one. And I think especially, you know, us in our daily lives, when we talk about eternity, we probably mean like train delays or, you know, being waiting on a phone line to the insurance company. But, you know, you know, with our very sort of limited lifespan, limited age of the planet, humanity, and all the rest of it, how can we even get towards making predictions about what happens trillions of years down the line? What do scientists actually use to give you clues about how things might evolve?
It's astonishing. It's a very good question. So with stars, so it's based on our understanding of nuclear physics, which is 1930s, 1940s, is less than 100 years old. But we now know with great precision what the sun is doing, how fast it's burning its nuclear fuel, how massive it is, how much fuel it has left. We understand these things from numerous measurements and theoretical advances. So we can look at the stars in the sky and we can estimate their masses and we can look at their light and we can see how hot they are. And we can put all that together and we can model the lifetime of a star. And the longest lived stars, by the way, are the least massive stars, which might seem kind of paradoxical. You might think, it's the biggest star that lives the longest. But actually a star is a battle between gravity trying to squash it it's basically a collapsing cloud of hydrogen and helium gas that's collapsing under its own gravity. If nothing else happened, it would just collapse and ultimately form a black hole. So what happens is that it gets very hot and starts burning nuclear fuel in its core, and that releases energy, which creates a pressure which holds the star up. But the more massive, the more enormous the star, the more fuel it has to burn to create the pressure to hold it up. So actually, it turns out that the most massive, huge stars have very short lifetimes, and small stars have very long lifetimes.
So there because are stars they consume less fuel to keep their shape intact.
So they're not trying to, they don't have to fight as much inward gravitational pull, basically. So they can be a bit more frugal.
And at the end of its life, these all collapse into individual black holes and that keeps expanding? Or
no, the lightest stars, and this was, by the way, in the 1920s and 1930s, was a big source of debate in science. And in fact, Robert Oppenheimer, who's very famous again now. Yeah. I mean, he's famous for the Manhattan Project, but also the film, the Chris Nolan film.
Yeah.
So Oppenheimer was one of the people who was calculating what happens when a star collapses. Is there anything that can stop it when it's run out of nuclear fuel? And there are things. So we get the lighter stars form, like the sun, will form a thing called the white dwarf, which is a lump of matter essentially about the size of the Earth. And it's held up by electrons. So the particles of electricity, if you like, jiggling around, trying to avoid each other as they collapse. So, and it's a quantum mechanical process, but essentially they jiggle and they can hold it up. But if you get too heavy, more than 1.4 times the mass of the sun, very famous number, then it collapses again. The electrons can't hold it up. Then neutrons start jiggling around and hold it up. That's called the neutron star. These are stars that are more massive than the sun, but the size of a city. These things are 10 kilometers or something across, but yet more massive than our sun, which is just mind-blowing. But if you get too heavy, even the neutrons jiggling won't hold it up. And that's when you collapse to form a black hole. And so the universe will be populated at some point in the far, far future by neutron stars, white dwarfs, black holes. Then we think the black holes ultimately have a lifetime. And even probably the neutron stars and white dwarfs evaporate away on some. We're talking, by the way, about, if you can imagine it, a number, something like 1 with 100 noughts or more after it. So the universe is 1 with 10 noughts after it, years old, give or take, right at the moment.
Yeah.
So we're talking 1 with 100 noughts. I mean, it's just unimaginable timescales.
Yeah. And then after that, we think Big Bang repeats itself all over again. Or where do we go from there? I mean, in the end, it kind of goes still. It's all time stops. And
We don't know. The great physicist Sir Roger Penrose, one of the great, who worked with Stephen Hawking, got much of the foundations of black holes and the Big Bang. He thinks that the universe will, in some sense, begin again. In the very far future, other people think it will just expand forever and nothing will happen. Other people think that maybe the thing driving the expansion, we don't even understand what that is. We call it dark energy. We have a tendency in physics to, if we don't know what something is, we call it dark. So some people think that'll change. And if that changes somehow, it may recollapse the universe. So we may live in this oscillating, bouncing universe. It's wonderful. We don't know.
I must try that with my CFO next time I can't explain something. Say it's probably a dark account or something.
I think dark money is probably something you shouldn't start talking about.
No, definitely not. I mean, you're somebody who's dealing with these kind of, you know, profound, huge questions every single day of your professional and personal life, probably. So how humbling do you find that experience when it comes to the little things and the stresses of daily life? And do you find is there sanity in putting things into perspective, or is it even more stressful?
You know, to quote Carl Sagan again, he said that astronomy, and you could substitute any all the things we've been talking about, but he said astronomy is a humbling and character building experience. And so the humbling is easy. We've talked about these vast timescales, just physically, you know, the idea that the Earth is one planet around one star amongst 400 billion stars, in one galaxy amongst 2 trillion galaxies. in a single patch of a potentially infinite universe, which some theories suggest may itself be a single bubble in an infinite sea of bubble universes. Yeah, okay. Clearly, we're small. Mm. But I think the character building is, as we discussed earlier, this idea that there are collections of atoms on this world that can think and philosophize and talk about the things we've talked about and discover time and think about time and build these wonderful mechanical machines, for example, these watches, that all those things are potentially extremely rare properties of the universe. Oh, and actually, when you put it like that, it's not surprising, is it? Because the fact that a load of hydrogen and helium atoms kind of collapsed into some stars, which made some oxygen and carbon, and then they exploded and some oxygen and carbon and iron got together on a planet, and then suddenly you have a civilization, it's a big ask when you put it like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that might, the character building bit is that we might have a tremendous responsibility, in a sense, to the universe, basically, which sounds a bit philosophical. But if you think about it, you know, we are a product of 13.8 billion years of universal evolution. This sort of thing, us, by which I mean humans, these things may have happened in very few places in a typical galaxy. And so suddenly the perspective flips over to me, and the character building bit is we are then charged, in a sense, with the responsibility of continuing this remarkable process of exploration and thought and feelings and all the things that we bring to the universe. I think that's quite, it's important to have both perspectives.
Yeah. And also this idea that we are probably, as you describe, extremely, extremely lucky to exist as a species and exist individually on this planet. And how dare we destroy it? You know, this is also the other perspective. You know, you say we have a responsibility towards the universe. We probably do.
Yeah. I mean, there's an argument to be made that, and many biologists I know, actually, as well as astronomers, make this argument that typically in a galaxy like the Milky Way, the number of civilizations might be zero. On average, typically. On average. So less than one per galaxy, yeah. Right? So on the average, which you know, may imply that we're the only one in this galaxy. And I think, you know, to have that perspective, to say, well, we talked about it, actually time, you know, is something to do with the motion of the Earth around the sun. We go back hundreds of years, as you said, and we're looking at these lights in the sky that are moving around. The planets are moving in the sky. The stars move every night from our perspective. So what is this thing? I do think that if this is the only world where anything thinks about that, then it becomes overwhelmingly valuable as a place.
Yeah.
So you're not daunted anymore. We shouldn't be daunted by the scale of the cosmos and the distances to these points of light, and even the planets, Jupiter, this enormous thing that orbits around the sun. We shouldn't be daunted by that. We should be daunted by our responsibility, given that we might be the only place where this happens, this strange thing, call it thought or consciousness, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think sometimes, you know, when we think about, you know, we spoke a lot now about science, but art, engineering, human creativity, human ingenuity, I think the things we are able to create sometimes are a really, yes, they're poetic, but they're also a powerful reminder of exactly that context you just described, you know, that it reminds us once in a while how we're unique, what we can do, but also what responsibility we carry because of it, you know, because we're extremely lucky to be here and because we have the ability to question things, to probe, to inquire, to find things out and work things out. And after we've done the how, then the next big question is the why, which is really then a whole new dimension. But maybe in this beautiful little niche industry somewhere between the fields of art and craftsmanship and engineering, trying to capture our understanding, trying to distill our understanding of the observable universe into a little instrument that can display correctly the phase of the moon, the day, the year, the leap years, the month, and all of those things as precisely as we possibly can, without using digital technology in something that is made and physically represents a system in space, because ultimately that's what a watch movement does, right? It actually does computation in space.
Yeah.
Right. And this is probably, you know, from a meaning perspective, why I sometimes enjoy looking at these machines so much, because I think they remind you of those bigger questions. They remind you of the bigger context, and they just remind you a little bit as well to be humble and grateful for what we have.
So it's beautifully put. And as you were saying that, even the materials out of which the watches are made. So some of the watches are made of gold, for example. It's a remarkable thing. If you go back about 20 years, then we were saying with confidence that gold is made in supernova explosions, which is a remarkable thing in itself, that it's manufactured and distributed into the universe in a few moments at the end of a star's life. But now we've seen gold being created in the collisions between neutron stars. Then you go, what? So that was an observation. So then you look at this machine, and as you said, it's not only this beautiful engineering, but the materials have this history. There will be gold atoms in that watch that were made in the collision between neutron stars, as far as we understand it.
That's a whole new sales pitch, Brian.
Yeah. Well, that's why there's not much gold.
Yeah, that's true. Precious metal,
it's quite
indeed.
Hard to make.
All we need is two neutron stars, quickly. Phone our colleagues at the CERN in Geneva. Maybe they can help us with that. Absolutely. And it came back to one of those discussions I had with my colleagues the other day, when we say, okay, you know, calendars, how long do they function? Do they last? And you think about how you'll explain this to a potential customer, and then you think, but hang on a minute. Okay, so let's think servicing. Okay, we have lubricants, we have moving parts. Yes, they will be replaced down the line during regular servicing. But then you think about the basic material components of the watch. You know, there's brass, there's metals like steel, there's gold, as you mentioned, there might be platinum, there's glass, there's all sorts of materials, where you then start to wonder, but hang on a minute, how long do they last potentially? And when do they start to corrode? And how long can I imagine that, you know, because I mean, our industry has been around a few hundred years. We've been around 155 years. So do we really know how long a movement base plate crafted from brass will actually last? You know, we don't, because it's never been tested. So
it's one of the things that I love so much about a watch that is designed to be accurate for in some tens of millions of years. I love that, because then it makes you ask those questions about engineering you'd never ask that about the manufacture of I don't know, a washing machine or a phone or anything.
Quite the opposite. Yeah. How quickly can we get them to replace it?
Yeah, you don't care so much, but you care about something that's designed to be accurate for millions of years, perhaps uniquely.
Yeah, and the only thing we know, really, I mean, that we understand in the history of sort of watchmaking is, yes, okay, if you take a coated brass dial to a watch, we see there's corrosion, there's patina. Maybe after a few decades, we've seen that, you know, so-called tropical dials. But beyond that, many of the movement components, we don't really know what the life cycle is going to be, because it's never been within the range of anybody ever questioning, you know. Yeah. But then when you start to think about this whole idea of calendars and start to think about eternity and what that means, suddenly you think, well, what about these materials? What about these alloys? What about glass? What about sapphire? Are those things that last? And then, you know, our material scientists spring into action and give us a good reassurance. But nevertheless, it opens a whole new discussion. And I think that alone makes these things really marvels of engineering and quite fascinating little machines.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Brian, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for opening our eyes a little bit to the big questions. And I think that's a fantastic motivation for many of our listeners to find out more and point out where we can find more. You have your own podcast. You can obviously come and see your shows, but give us a little bit of an insight where we can see more of Brian.
Yes, as you say, I do live events, live shows around the world. We've started pairing up with orchestras now, which I'm very excited about. We did a, a wonderful event at the Sydney Opera House in December last year, which was just magnificent. Actually, many of the things we've discussed about meaning, about what these discoveries mean, how we set those ideas against Mahler and Strauss and Sibelius. And that's a beautiful thing that I'm hoping to do in London this year, and then around Europe and indeed around the world in the coming few months and years. So yeah, we've got a podcast called The Infinite Monkey Cage, which is on BBC, a BBC podcast, as all sorts of places, and also events with you, of course.
Absolutely. And of course, to all our listeners who want to find out more and hear more from Brian, this is the eve of Watches and Wonders. Watches and Wonders, the fair with the unveiling of the new collection from IWC, will start on the coming Tuesday at 9 a.m. in the morning. Check out watchesandwonders.com, IWC.com, and our social channels to follow all of the developments in the week. And then Brian will join me live in Geneva for a live webcast on Wednesday at 4 p.m., where you'll hear more about all of the fantastic insights and fascinating insights that Brian will share with us on the day. So in the meantime, stay tuned. See you all next week in Geneva.